like a movie, then she's calling. Forest fires, cougars mauling. Take a chance and roll the dice one day. If you're a DM, players find you. Millennials can join this quest too. Expedition, we're gonna find a way. The Grizzly Pace. The Grizzly Pace. The Grizzly Pace.
So, we're on the road again. On the road again. My friends probably think that all we do is travel, because we seem to do a lot of it. But no, it's the first time in a year. Last time we came to Palm Springs was a year ago, so I don't feel like it's excessive. I don't feel like it's excessive, but it feels just about right. But talking about feeling just about right, I don't feel just about right this morning because I have got a bit of a hangover. I don't drink a lot. In fact, I'm very moderate, highly moderate, especially since I've been on this sort of health kick for the last year. I actually stopped drinking weekdays, only drink on weekends, and then it's only like one or two beers on a Saturday, Friday or Saturday night. However, yeah, I've been slipping a bit. And last night, I had a few too many. But there was a good reason for it. You know, I think it's justified. I think you need to justify your drinking habits to yourself, if to no one else. And the reason it's justified is we are having a happy hour. A happy hour. Not a work happy hour. This was a Grizzly Peaks happy hour. Huh? Yeah, that's a thing. This is now a thing. It's all down to my friend E, who is one of the players in my Berlin campaign, one of my New York friends. And she suggested once, you know, we have a Discord server for Grizzly Peaks Radio where patrons, I still don't know what to call them, patrons and players and the players from the various campaigns, we all sort of gather and chat and whatever. But E's idea was to have an actual happy hour where we all, you know, maybe on a Friday for an hour or so, have a drink on the video chat. And we've had three so far. Maybe it's only two. No, I think we've had three. And various people have turned up, and we even had people showing up in UK time zone, which was 2:30 in the morning, which is a bit insane, I thought, but great. I think that was Anthony Lee Dudley who showed his face. And gosh, I mean, I can't stay up till 2:30 in the morning anymore. That's beyond the pale. But well done, Anthony. And last night was another sort of random selection of friends from the server, from the Discord community. And let's say I was a bit drunk to start with. I was already a bit drunk. Done a bit of afternoon drinking. And because I'm on holiday, all right, okay? And for some reason, I decided we'd do a round robin question. What's the most embarrassing sex you've ever had? And then it went downhill from there. I feel a bit guilty. One, for lowering the tone by asking such a needlessly intrusive question of people, but everyone was quite game. I will not say who was there or who said what. That is for between me and those people that were on that Discord chat. Let's say it was a bit eye-opening, and that's not a metaphor. Well, I suppose it is a metaphor, isn't it? But it's not the metaphor. Yeah, Anyway, we're in Bakersfield right now, halfway. We're at the midpoint. The midpoint, and it's the mid-century. And is it mid-century? No. I think that's what they call this style of architecture, mid-century modern, or but it's sort of Art Deco as well. So they have these old Art Deco buildings here. And this place really is a kind of a weird town. Could have been great at some point, but it feels like the whole thing is just crumbling away in front of your very eyes. But anyway, you don't want to hear this. What you want to hear are people talking about whether the GM and the player are playing the same game. Yeah? You didn't know you wanted to hear that. You probably didn't know you wanted to hear that. But no, I said that this topic was dead and buried. And it did cause some quite intense reactions, pro and con. More intense con, let's say. Because I think there's a, it could feel like a provocative thing to say if you disagree with it. But I actually did get a load of calls in response to it and people's perspectives on it. I think it's worth putting them on. And I feel kind of bad because these messages have been sitting in my Anchor inbox for months and months and months. It's because I kind of fell off. I fell off, man. But I'm sort of back on now, am I? I don't know. I feel like I have got a few things to say now, so, well, you might be hearing more of me, for better or for worse.
Hey, Andy, I guess some of your discussion comments made me think about something you said about players having agency, or not agency, but caring about their player characters. And maybe that's why I'm not such a fan of convention play or West Marchant style play, because I see that many players feel their characters are a throwaway, which I don't like or really get into. Another thing you mentioned, and I guess it's disappointing, that you don't like to play in games because you don't want to get attached to a character. Maybe I'm mishearing. But as, you know, I GM'd a whole lot, and I do prefer to GM, but I think, and I've had a discussion with Joe and Daniel, or at least they called in and commented, that sometimes it's good to be a player so you learn to be a better GM. Not that maybe you need any improvement. Maybe you do. Who knows?
Yeah, Dave here. Interesting. I'll have to maybe to go check out these heavyweights talking about that on the Discord. But I agree with you. Definitely the GM and the players are definitely playing a different game. I've been doing a D&D campaign now for 5 years with my two boys and their friends. And things have definitely... It's very strange. I feel like I'm attached to some of the NPCs very closely. Whereas the players, of course, they are attached to their characters and they have much different goals than I do. Mine is to continue the story in divergent ways based on what they're doing. Theirs is to become more powerful, finish these variety of quests. Anyway, interesting subject. Take care.
Regarding the game the players play, and the game the player, the gamekeeper, master of lore, however you want to call it, I think it is two different games, because the one person, like, they are playing the same game, but this is a difficult one to go back and forth, like through an email or responses, because it can easily be concluded together that they are all playing the same game, yes. But the gamekeeper has to do a lot more world building and creation of all the NPCs and all the monsters and all the background information for the players or the player characters to be involved in. So it is kind of two games, in my humble opinion. further to my last message, I listened to all the messages from Jules, and I think it's two games. Because like when I'm the dungeon master for my boys' games, I go based on what they're interested in, and I try to create a world that challenges them and brings lots of opportunities for them, but also difficult decisions for them. But I am also doing part of the game for me is creating the whole world, whereas they're coming to experience and create the story together with me as part of the game. But I see that as two different roles. Same game, two different roles. So maybe we're just talking apples and oranges, or maybe we're just talking about different types of apples.
My goodness, I'm so happy you used the word asymmetry. I'm out here walking my dog, listening to your podcast about the question raised as to whether the GM and players are playing the same game. I know it's kind of a provocative question. It's a question meant to cause arguments. Sorry about the car noises. But, you know, interesting arguments all the same, right? And I kind of wanted to get to this idea that starting with board games, going all the way back to games like Hnefatafl, which was kind of, some people call it Viking chess, there have been asymmetrical rule sets in that one. The king and his men are trapped in the center of the board, and the opponent, the opposing player is all around the outside. And the rules, the victory conditions differ. You know, one's trying to escape, one's trying to trap, blah, blah, blah. There's also Mastermind. Remember that game where you got the colored pegs, one person knows the code and the other person's trying to guess it, and you put in little clue pegs. Oh, hang on. And if we look at more modern games, there's Roll Through the Ages. I don't know if you've ever played that, but it is a civilization-building game using a Yahtzee-like mechanic, and everybody plays with their own dice rolls and their own score sheets, and really are kind of playing their own game. They're all playing the same set of rules, but there are different paths to victory, so everybody can be playing a different kind of game. And there's some interaction, but mostly it's, you know, kind of a self-facing multiplayer game. And of course, those are all board games. Since none of those are role-playing games, it's not exactly a valid analogy. But I do think that you've hit on the main idea there with the word asymmetry. Of course, you're playing the same game, the GM and the players. You're playing the same set of rules. You're playing the same branded product. You're often playing in the same time and space, although you could be doing play-by-post as well, which would mean the synchronicity of it all is spread out. But of course, the fundamental experience is different. There is your side of the rules, whichever side you're sitting on, the player side or the GM side, and there's their side of the rules, and they are different. You have different rules available to you. You have different powers within those rules. The traditional split is that, you know, the GM can't tell you what your character thinks, does, or says, but basically controls everything else, and, you know, world versus the characters. But, you know, you even have just different, they just feel different, don't they? One person is allowed to invent, whereas the other one has to react to what is given. So in that respect, sure, of course, they're playing different games, but only in a, only in an academic sense, right? The literal question is they're playing the same game, of course. Well, brother, I'm still at it. It just occurred to me that I probably should have said something about spheres of control. You know, it seems to me like modern D&D 3X forward was kind of about defining those spheres of control for players better so that they have more control over the rules than they once had. I don't know if that's true. That's just kind of a statement off the top of my head. But I do think that that's probably the best way to ask that question is like, what are the differences between the spheres of control and the game mechanics available to the GM and the players within the structure of the same game, quote unquote, the same game? These can all just be between you and me. I'm so far behind anyway that they're probably no longer relevant. But I love that comment about how if you're too much of a fan of NPCs as GM that you're a shitty GM. Totally true. Can't stand that stuff. It's the same as for the plot, right? If you're too much of a fan of anything that you've created and you prefer it over things that the players, I'll use the word invent, but you know what I mean, introduce into the fiction, the kind of goals they have, the directions they want to turn. If you as a GM block that with your own inventions, you really are abusing the system that already gives you basically all the power in the world. So yeah, that's a crappy way to be. And it's really actually just being like a bad friend, right? It's like, imagine you and I go to the movies a lot and I only ever want to see the movies that I want to see and don't give you a chance to, you know, basically just override you every time you pick a movie. That would suck. You wouldn't see movies with me very often. So.
And unless anyone else calls in, I think that is the final word on the topic. Or it damn well should be. From Carl and Dave and Ray. I mean, really, we should put this one to bed now, shouldn't we? But maybe someone else will call in response to their points. No, thank you all. Thank you all for backing me up. I know I wasn't the lone voice of insanity. Yeah, let's leave it there. But, you know, as if I didn't need any more validation, here's some nice people making some nice comments about things. I'll be back to you after these messages.
Just in case you do happen to do another episode, I'm replying. I meant 15 Call of Cthulhu scenarios besides what I played with you. I played through all kinds of classic ones before we were playing that together. I went through a phase where I actually kind of liked the game, and then I think I Cthulhu'd out. As far as the Berlin thing, I think, yes, you're right, it is a campaign. I think if we weren't playing Pulp, though, that goddess thing would have gone way differently. So I can't say, and I don't think that adventure is written for Pulp, right? So I think we probably mostly would have been downed in that final conflict if it was not for Pulp. So I don't know about that balance. You're doing a great job. So like I say, I like running and playing with you in the Call of Cthulhu, but honestly, you'll never see me in another Call of Cthulhu game that you're not running, almost certainly.
Just a update from Dave here on the Two-Headed Serpent, the Pulp Scott Doward scenario. Just top-notch, of course, as always. I waited for the second episode to drop before I started because I wanted to get that much more. I had a bit of work to do, and I wanted to enjoy that so much. The music, as always, is spot on. Andy definitely is bringing his A game for this group, as well as the investigators are all unique in their different ways. I definitely look forward to all the episodes and appreciate the time and effort that you take to bring them to us. All the best. Cheers.
Well, thank you for that, Daniel. I mean, I suppose if you can somehow persuade someone to play a game that they absolutely hate and keep on playing it for a year and a half, I guess that is a vindication of sorts. Although Daniel is not someone that just will take it lying down. he always wants to probe and prod and challenge, and that's what I love about having him as a player, is I think he makes me a better GM. He's like, it's like I always feel like I'm in the exam room. Not in the medical sense, because I know in America they call them exam room. I think they call them exam rooms, where you go and see the doctor. We don't call them that. An exam room is where you go and take an exam. you take your history 101. Thank you, Daniel. And I we've had a really nice response. I keep saying we now when I mean really mean me. I guess it's to make it feel like Grizzly Peaks is something more than it is, which is just one man's lonely witterings, but one man's crusade against something or other. And with a lot of help from my friends. I get a lot of help from my friends, obviously, but, you know. So, yeah, people seem to have enjoyed the GaryCon roundups, and there's just some general good feelings, and you know, Daniel leaves another message, and Rob seems like we might tempt him halfway around the world at some point to take part. Is that a possibility, Rob? That'd be kind of cool. I know you have a penchant for the drunk cast yourself, from what I hear. So maybe that's what we need to do, a three-way drunk cast next year at GaryCon, eh? You, me, and Daniel.
Hey, Andy, this is Rob, also known as Menion. It's really good to hear you give these reports of GaryCon. Brilliant to hear you meeting up with Daniel of Bandits Keep. I really wish I could be there and have a drink with you. I'll probably try and keep my eyes off those long ears, but the beer would be great. I was just really surprised you were running an AD&D adventure, and that's fantastic. And I totally agree where you're coming from. I mean, I run a lot of AD&D, and the rules, the way the rules are just all over the place in the different books is infuriating, frequently infuriating. But I think you're on to something where you say you can ignore a lot and you can jump around, and there's a lot of leeway. But I think more important than that, and more important than big ears, is the point that you make about the nostalgia. Nostalgia doesn't carry you on in a game. And not even the rules do, I guess. So the important thing at the end of the day, I suppose, is whether you can sit down at the table, play that game, and just still enjoy it. It's not going to be the same as when you're 14, and why should it be? But if you can still have a great time playing the game, and perhaps very different experiences playing the game, then that's more than you can really ask for, I suppose. But it's very fun. Funny to hear you playing AD&D, and I look forward to you coming back as one of these AD&D freaks. So take care now. Enjoy the rest of the con.
Hey, Andy, Jason here. Yep, some of your old-time listeners are still around. Really enjoyed listening to your Gen Con recaps. Thank you for doing that. For those of us who couldn't make it, you know, it helps us see what we missed, and glad you had a great time. Hopefully the Goodman Games Switch thing works out. Glad you got to hook up with Daniel. And, yeah, so keep being you, and I will talk to you soon. Take care.
Andy, Daniel from Bandits Keep. Yes, obviously I was at GaryCon with you, and GaryCon is amazing. It's definitely on my I will do every year that I possibly can list. I think that the only other con that's there for me currently is ShireCon, which is in Connecticut. It's a one-day con. It is very small and very cool. I will say I've been to Gen Con twice now, and I'm going again this year. Gen Con is great for the sheer size of it. So if you want to be like completely overwhelmed by but tons and tons of RPG product everywhere, the vendor hall alone takes a full day. There's tons of LARPs and all kinds of stuff going on. If you really want that immersion, then I think Gen Con's worth trying once. But it's a lot of people and a much different feel. And like I said, if there was any con that I would go to every year, which I plan on doing, it is definitely GaryCon.
And now for some more commentary, thinly disguising my need to have more praise heaped upon me from Jason. Jason makes some really cool points in the next few messages about realism this topic about realism. And actually, Daniel also makes a comment about it. He has a slightly different perspective, but in the end, they come to the same conclusion that that maybe it's just something that I love doing. Maybe pure fantasy, like a world where anything goes, anything can happen, isn't something I'm interested in anymore. I need to have a world where there's some kind of internal logic or consistency or a depth that comes from realism. And that's, I suppose, what I find most compelling about it, is that there's layers and layers and layers of depth that you can dig into to create something really rich. So there's also something about punching for clues that I really like. The idea of punching for clues is a pretty cool idea, really, in the end. After all, who hasn't wanted to do that in their wish fulfillment fantasies?
Hey, Andy, Jason here, just catching up on episode 369. Been kind of busy, so I'm behind my podcast listening. But I don't pay new TSR any mind or any of that stuff. I think, oh, it's pretty silly. The thing is, I personally, and I can only speak for myself, of course, I personally am not really interested in new versions of these games. You know, I like Star Frontiers, but I like the original Star Frontiers. And the same thing with, like, Boot Hill. Like, I wouldn't want a new version of Boot Hill. I like the original version of Boot Hill. So I don't even see the nostalgia in the... If you were going to reprint the original, that has interest to me. But coming up with a different version of it just doesn't... It doesn't appeal to me. So I guess I'm not their target audience. And as far as the shenanigans, yeah, it's silly. But anyhow, let me get back to your episode. Hey, Andy, Jason here, still listening to 369. I agree with you 100% on Gumshoe, a problem in search of a solution in search of a problem. Okay, I'm saying that wrong. Sorry, driving down the road. But I agree with you 100%. It's a non-issue, and I am not a fan of Gumshoe at all. Which is nothing against people who like it. That's fine if that's their thing, but I would much... Like, our mutual friend Carl Rodriguez really wants to play Dracula, or wants to run the Dracula dossier, which is fine. I just don't particularly want to play Knight's Black Agents. But, I mean, I'll end up playing it because he's my buddy. But, yeah, I just don't see the need for Gumshoe. I never understood the idea of you can't find the clue, because, like you say, of course they find the clue. Otherwise, what's the point? So, anyway, let me get back to the show. Okay, Andy, just finished 369. You know, one thing I've always appreciated is you appreciate the sensitivity and the potential issues when you look at these games and these scenarios and modules, but you're still willing to drive on with them and do them. You just figure out how to approach them the right way. And I really like that, as opposed to just steering totally clear, which, don't get me wrong, a group, they don't feel they can handle something, you know, Nazi Germany or, you know, the way Egypt is shown in the 20s or whatever. If you don't think you can handle it in a sensitive manner, maybe you skip it. But I appreciate your stick-to-itiveness and your desire to find a way to run it, but to handle it right. So I realize there's a big pat on the back, and maybe that's dangerous, but I think you deserve it. As far as the, I forget what I should have called in right away, but as far as the investigative technique of just, you know, punching until you find a clue, that is an American, that may happen in British literature too, but that's a very American thing. In our pulps, in our detective stories, you see that throughout American fiction, where, you know, whether it's Raymond Chandler, you know, who's advice to writers, and I might be wrong here, but I'm pretty sure it was Chandler that said, you know, if you hit a wall, have somebody shoot at your character, right? Or, you know, Robert B. Parker, who wrote the Spencer for Hire novels, where Spencer, you know, well, you just, you poke your nose around enough places and bother enough people, somebody's going to take a swing at you, and then you concentrate on that person and follow that trail, people that are trying to stop your investigation, and that's how you'll solve the mystery. And that's really common in American fiction.
Insofar as the playing in the real world and Cthulhu and all this other stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, it's a line, right? That you got to be careful. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of it. I know that you love playing in the real world. I actually don't like doing it for exactly the reasons that you put out there. When I'm playing fantasy, I want to play fantasy, whether it be horror or heroic fantasy. I don't want to have to think about it. This really happened to people. You know, the atrocities that humans can do to each other and all that other kind of stuff. I'm much more of a Texas Chainsaw Massacre horror person than a this really happened documentary horror person. But you know, give it a shot. We'll see where it goes. It's not usually, you know, something that I'm comfortable exploring, especially not as a referee. As a player, I'm going to give it a shot. If anybody can pull it off, I think you can.
Excellent stuff there from Jason. Thank you, Jason, for some really cool messages. I'm missing the interchange. I guess what happens when you don't put episodes out for ages is that people stop listening, people stop calling in, and no one thinks you're a moron. Or do they? Or do they? I mean, maybe someone does. Anyway, after this someone, who actually is factually incorrect in one major part of his message, and he already knows it, and I won't embarrass him by telling him what it is. But after that someone calls in, I get a really nice and long message sent by Safer Fantasy Crafting, who, again, I miss the messages. So maybe that's the endorphin rush that I need to get me back. Is the pleasure, really, the pleasure of getting people calling in and interacting. Yeah. All right. So here's someone, and then Safer. And after my response to Safer, I think we will call it a day.
Wait, stop it, you moron. What are you talking about? See, you're wrong again, Andy. Wrong. There are people listening, and there are people that are going to call in and tell you to stop it. Oh, mate. You don't put eel sauce on pie and mash. It's like a parsley sauce, and they call it liquor. The eels, the jellied eels, are a totally separate thing that you get in the pie and mash shop. So you can stop that as well whilst you're at it. But the whole Buddhist thing, yeah, I was reading Buddhism when I was at college. Not officially, I just went to the library, got the books out, and it kind of got me down, if I'm honest. I think I feel a bit like you. I probably just didn't get it, or I don't know. Anyway, take care, mate. Catch you later.
Hello, Andy. It's just Safer here. I just thought I'd send you a message after your last podcast. You've managed to pique my interest a bit and perhaps touch a nerve with your talk of running a Cthulhu game during the Nazi Germany era. I appreciate your dilemma there, and I'm not Jewish myself, but I have sympathy for you as a Jewish man not wanting to treat that with insensitivity. And wanting to get it right and not diminish the horror of it. So I just thought of something that might be an idea for you. Perhaps I'm just sticking my nose in, perhaps where it's not really wanted, but I thought perhaps you could use, not have you thought of using sort of Pan's Labyrinth approach that Guillermo del Toro uses in his movie, where he juxtaposes the an imagined fantasy horror world of a little girl in the middle of the Spanish Civil War, and he juxtaposes that against the real life horror of Franco's fascists, and at the start of that movie, the monsters in the girl's fantasy world seem truly horrible and horrific, but by the end of the movie, he's flipped it, and it's clear that it's the Nazis that are the real gut-wrenching evil in the world, and the horrible monsters of the girl's fantasy, by the end of the movie, they turn into an almost wholesome, certainly comforting escape for the little girl by the end of the movie. And I think that might be a way of doing it, Andy, in that rather than risk diminishing the evil of the Nazi regime. I think if you actually sort of diminished the horror of the cosmic horror, the Cthulian horror, and used that to juxtapose against the fascist horror and actually enhance the fascist horror in comparison. I don't know if you've seen Pan's Labyrinth. I'm trusting that you have. It might seem that doing that by intentionally diminishing the cosmic horror to actually reinforce the horror of the Nazis might seem like throwing or tipping Lovecraft's cosmology on its head. But I'm not sure it would actually in reality, because I think in Lovecraft's cosmology, the Cthulian entities, they're not really presented as evil as such. They're just presented as alien. It's our reaction. It's the human reaction to these creatures that's horrific and extreme. But the creatures themselves are often portrayed as just other, not actually or beyond the bounds of human morality and ideas of good and evil. And even like in the Mountains of Madness, Lovecraft seems to have some sympathy for the Elder Things when the Elder Things reawaken after they're frozen from their frozen tomb, when they're discovered by the human expedition. They tear the humans apart in a brutal, vicious, savage way, and it's quite disgusting to the protagonists of the story when they encounter these dismembered expedition scientists. But Lovecraft describes that as simply the actions of confused, scared men. He describes the Elder Things as just like men who are now in a confusing world outside their own, and he describes what they did to the expedition as simple alien, just curiosity, not real evil, not real malice, but just curiosity, which is kind of horrific in itself, really, as you think about it. But later on, he seems to have sympathy for the Elder Things when they encounter the Shoggoth underneath the city, and he imagines what terror they must have experienced returning back to their abandoned ancient city to suddenly find it overrun by their previous servants and having to face this awful polymorphic monster. So sympathy for the monsters, I think, is present in Cthulhu and isn't antithetical to it. So yeah, just some ideas for you, Andy, if you wanted to consider them on how you might want to broach the subject. I don't know if they're welcome ideas or not, but I did also, perhaps as a segue, I did want to say about your earlier podcasts about GaryCon reports. I really enjoyed them as well, Andy, and I was really glad to hear the joy in your voice while you were there. There was clear joy in your voice. I mean, even in one of your early reports, you mentioned that you just can't recapture that childhood sense of joy that you had when you first got into role-playing. But from the sound of your voice, I think you got pretty close there, Andy. I think there was clearly a lot of joy. You were really clearly enjoying it, and it came through in that podcast, and I really enjoyed those podcasts as well. But yeah, I hope you're doing well, mate. I hope everything's going fine. I'm glad you enjoyed GaryCon, and I just thought I'd, you know, stick my nose in again, perhaps where it's not wanted, but all the best. You take care.
So lots to unpack there, Safer. One thing you got to say about Safer: he doesn't call in often, but when he does, whew, it's a doozy. And that was a doozy. Thank you so much, Safer. Lots to think about and lots to ponder. Firstly, again, thank you. It seems like this is the Goodman Appreciation Month or something. I don't know. It's like no one in my real life ever gives me compliments like this. So I'll rely on you, Anchor Buddies, to bolster the old self-confidence. But other than that, great idea. But you know, Pan's Labyrinth is an amazing film, and I think in a way it almost as an example of where it's hard to translate the clever conceit of a movie into a role-playing game. I think this is one example. Whilst I think, yes, in theory, making the real horror, as you said, and as we all know, the real horror being the humans and not the monsters, as it were. Whilst I think that works beautifully in a movie, and in fact, it goes back a long, long way, where the monster is man and man is the monster. You know, there's so many examples of that. I'm not even going to bother recounting them. And Pan's Labyrinth follows in that gorgeous tradition. Or follows gorgeously in that tradition, because what I mean to say, because it is such a visually arresting film. But I think in the context of a role-playing game, I think it's a bit hard to do that because you know, I think you want to fight against the ultimate bad guys, you know, the incredibly powerful and mysterious creatures. I think that's what we probably generally play role-playing games for. And if they become somehow docile, friendly, and you know, misunderstood, I think it might actually undercut the challenge and the fun and the excitement of the campaign. And the reason for that, the reason I'll state that, he says stammering, the reason I'll state that is that you often fight humans in Call of Cthulhu. In fact, by and large, you do. And there's nothing to say those can't be fun. And they are fun. And I think any keeper who's ever run Call of Cthulhu will realize that they're the... they're the aperitif, really, before the main course. And that's how most campaigns and most scenarios are structured, is that you encounter the humans first, and the threat builds and builds until you end up facing the powerful creatures, or even the gods of the mythos, the great old ones. You don't really face them, you just end up getting squashed by them. But, so, can you invert it? Could you sort of almost do a double switchback where you know, you encounter the human, you know, you have the human minions, then the monsters appear, you try to, I suppose I'm talking myself into doing this, then you try to you know, deal with them in the way that you normally would, and then you realize that they're actually being manipulated, tortured, mind controlled by powerful humans, human sort of wizard entities. I think the problem with that is that it really isn't in the Lovecraft canon at all for that to happen. Human beings are always at the mercy, manipulated and destroyed by these entities. That's the sort of bleakness of the universe, is that we don't have control over these things. So I think you could do it, but not in Call of Cthulhu. it's probably my conclusion that I'm coming to, safer. But yeah, I think both you and Daniel, and praise aside, I would just finish up by maybe trying to think a little bit about why I like gaming in the real. And so many people, I think, probably don't. You know, you hear this refrain a lot, is that I don't play role-playing games to think about the real world. I play role-playing games to get away from the real world. Daniel, I think, more or less says that. But you hear it a lot as a rebuff. Is that the right word? A rebuff? I mean, you can rebuff someone, but is rebuff also a noun? A rebuff? I think it is. If it isn't, it should be, as a rebuff to people actually trying to talk about serious issues in any forum. You know, it's like, I don't come here to think about the real world. I come here to get away from it, you know, on Facebook groups and things like that. And, you know, you don't have to bring politics into my gaming and all this stuff. And I'm not for a minute suggesting that's what Daniel... was saying, not at all. I know Daniel far too well to make that kind of a category error about him. He's a very thoughtful and politically engaged person. But I suppose what it is that that stuff isn't exactly fun, is it? You know, having to engage with the problems of the real world. But and that's not what I want to do either. That absolutely is not what I want to do either. I don't want to think about the misery, the real misery of war. If we run this World War II Cthulhu game, it's very much the fictional milieu of war. You know, I grew up, you know, I'm of an age when all the films we saw on TV were all war films. We were, you know, I grew up in the 70s. So, and weird though that is to think, I was born only 23 years after the end of World War II. That's nothing. That's nothing when I think about how time passes now. I still think of 2000 as being recent, and that's 22 years ago. So we grew up in a time when World War II was still so much in the consciousness of humanity. And it's definitely gone now. I don't think people think about World War II anymore, at least, you know, unless you're really, you know, old enough to have actually lived through it, and there's not a lot of people around, you know, you'd be, you know, you'd be to remember it and to have actually sort of been sort of affected by it in a really conscious way, you know, you'd have to be in your 80s, late 80s, early 90s now. So what? So growing up with that culture, with that media, where World War II was so predominant, it's almost like this mythic. It's a mythic sort of story for me. It's and like all myths, it's full of tragedy, of course, and full of horror, and the worst of humanity, but also the best of humanity as well. There's a lot of heroism depicted, and maybe a lot of it is exaggerated, but that's what gives us a sort of hope that even in the worst of times, as we're seeing now, even in the worst of times, people can show the best of humanity. So what am I saying? I'm not saying I'm trying to create some grand statement of anything at all, or through putting things in the real world. But I think what it does for me is it enables me to explore certain themes, ideas, and also to kind of put things in front of players that they wouldn't necessarily think about if it was a completely fictionalized setting, or one where there wasn't this sort of weight of reality, where their actions actually have real consequences. And I feel that getting, you know, one of the hardest things to do as a games master is to get your players to really care about their actions in the setting, you know, like in a moral way. This sounds terrible now I'm talking about it. You know, players generally make their characters fairly amoral in most, you know, it's like they in virtually every game system they go around murdering people. Now whether or not those people deserve to be murdered or not is a different question, but whether they do or not, that is not up to you as an individual to murder someone that is a terribly bad person in any kind of civilized society. And when you put realism, when you make the setting real and demonstrate real consequences for those things, I think it creates a much more interesting and ambiguous and thought-provoking setting to play your character in, because you have to consider far more deeply what the impact of your behavior is going to have on the people around you. And I personally feel that doing that in a real setting just makes it more accessible to do that. You know, we all instinctively know what's going to happen if you do certain things. Now, I'm not saying that always plays out. If it always played out, your PCs in a Call of Cthulhu game would be in prison or within two sessions, and that would be it. And of course, you shouldn't do that. That's a silly way to put realism into your game, but I guess heightened hyper-realism is really what I'm after. The hyper-realism of Babylon Berlin, the amazing TV show that has actually probably been a huge and a conscious and unconscious inspiration for me in running Berlin, the Wicked City. So yeah, consequences. Consequences make for interesting situations, I think. Lack of consequences make things too linear, too simple. It's like, where's the dilemma if you know that there are no consequences for killing your enemy? When there are, then you have to think much more deeply about what you're going to do, and perhaps do things that are very realistic in terms of what a character would do, but not very common, like just letting them go, letting them complete their hideous task, their hideous goal, because you want to save your skin. I think that's more interesting in a way sometimes. I don't want it all the time, but I think sometimes that's a really interesting decision to make. And then the ramifications, the roller coaster, the sort of domino effect of what happens from there can make a campaign fly. It can create ongoing storylines, recurring villains. It can create debt, like moral debt. It can create guilt. It can really drive amazing character development. And I think that has happened to some extent in our Berlin game, and I would like it to carry on. I think it happens in some of my games, not all of them. And I don't think I want it in all of them. Some of them, you just want to punch a Nazi in the face and get away with it. That's all right, after all. All right, that's it. See you maybe not as soon as the last episodes might imply. I think I will go back to a more sporadic schedule now, but hopefully we'll get some messages and maybe that will drive me on to the next one.
It's a game we're role-playing. I'm a stranger and you're making mistakes after mistakes. No one can hear your pleading. The wind drowns out your screaming. They'll never smell your body.